It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Betty Fussell has been writing about food for 50 years. So what made food so compelling?
To eat is to live, and to live is to die. So the whole enchilada is embedded in our daily need to eat. All critters eat. Baby says, feed me, and there's milk and there's mama. That's how we learn about other people. That's how we learn about the outside. So to eat is to know. And because I'm at the end of my life, I can look back and say, oh my God, the narrative is clear. And every bite I eat, every meal I make, has the whole cycle in it. That is enormously exciting.
Betty Fussell, Why We Love Bitter, and International Breakfasting with Kenji Lopez-Alt, coming up this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Kenji Lopez-Alt says that when he was a kid, he was a little nerdling. It figures since he grew up to be, logically, an MIT grad, not logically, a pro cook, and finally his true calling. Kenji is the food scientist at Serious Eats. He's also the kind of eater who's always discovering something you have to know about. Kenji, welcome.
Oh, it's so good to be back. Thank you.
So you did a piece on breakfast around the world. How did this come about?
I've always loved traveling, and it's always interested me. Breakfast, we have a couple of our sweet things and a couple of our savory things, but it's mostly, you know, eggs and toast and things like that.
Right.
But as you travel around the world, you discover that that's not how people eat their breakfast all around the world at all. You know, some people, they'll eat fish for breakfast, or they'll eat stew, or they'll eat nothing but coffee and a piece of pastry. So it's just fascinating to me, like the breadth of different types of food that people eat as the first meal of their day.
So what did you eat for breakfast when you were growing up?
It was a mix of things. My mother was Japanese, and I lived with my maternal grandparents as well. So sometimes we would have Japanese food. So things like tarako, which is a salted cod roe. So my grandmother had a little miniature charcoal grill that she would grill it over inside and then serve that kind of crumbled up on top of rice. We would have tamago kake gohan, which is rice with a raw egg stirred into it. So rice, a little pinch of salt, a little pinch of MSG powder, actually, a little dash of soy sauce, and then an egg kind of broken over the top. And you whip it up with chopsticks, and the egg kind of cooks a little bit from the heat of the rice, but it gets this really nice sort of frothy, light texture. So it's sort of like a porridge, but also slightly souffled. So really, really nice and light. So we ate stuff like that, but we also ate a lot of, you know, Western things. So, you know, breakfast cereal, Cocoa Puffs was my favorite. My mom would make French toast, sometimes pancakes, you know, a mix of sort of Western and Japanese foods. Because my mother did move here from Japan, when she was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite breakfast of all time. And I mean, I grew up in New York, so a really good fresh bagel with cream cheese. But when you go to, say, Vietnam, it's not atypical to have a bowl of noodles with broth for breakfast. And to me, that's one of those dishes that I actually eat at breakfast for home as well, whether it's Japanese noodles or Chinese noodles or even, you know, in college, it was probably a bowl of instant ramen. But I find that, for me personally, that, you know, that salty kick and the starches, it's sort of like eating, you know, toast with good salted butter, but just in a different form. You get that same mix of salt and carbs. And I find that to be really attractive. And of course, you know, then there's the British or the Irish fry up, which is the perfect hangover cure breakfast.
Yeah, lots of good fat. Lots of fat.
Yeah. Yes, seven different types of sausages.
And fried bread that's been fried in bacon drippings. Let us not forget this genius. It's fabulous. But you know, what you really had me in the article when you started talking about Asia. How does China eat breakfast?
Well, so, you know, my wife and I, we spent a good amount of time traveling through China a couple of years ago. And our one basic rule while we were traveling is that if we saw a plume of steam or smoke coming out of an alleyway, that we would investigate. And I think one of the best breakfasts we had was in Beijing, where we were still a little bit jet lagged and we were wandering the streets at 4:30 in the morning. And we saw some steam coming out of an alleyway. And it turned out it was a woman preparing dumplings for the breakfast rush that was going to start, you know, an hour or two later. And we were the first customers there, and she had these, you know, freshly hand crimped and steamed dumplings that were just delicious. You know, that there's that. There's also Jianbing, which is this Chinese savory crepe. So it's made on the same sort of, you know, those wide flat cast iron discs that they make crepes on in France. On the exact same. Yeah, the exact same tool, and you just start with a sort of more savory crepe batter, and it gets painted with chili oil and with hoisin sauce, and then an egg gets placed directly on top of it and kind of gets swirled around, and then you get cilantro and sesame seeds and chilies, and sometimes you can wrap up a piece of fried tofu puff or fried chicken, and it's sort of like just imagine a crepe crossed with, say, like a spring roll, so, you know, crispy and really satisfying. It's one of my favorite breakfasts anywhere.
How about Indonesia? We never hear about stuff from Indonesia.
Well, fried rice or fried noodles, bami goreng or nasi goreng, you know, sort of similar to what you might be familiar with at a Chinese restaurant, except the flavorings are a little bit different. So the main flavoring would be ketchup manis, which is the sweet sort of syrupy soy sauce that they use in Indonesia, along with chilies. Chilies and vegetables, maybe some cucumbers on the side. You know, sometimes you can top it with a fried egg if you'd like. But you know, the main component is that starch. It's going to be those noodles or the rice.
It sounds pretty swell.
Yeah.
What about someplace like Singapore / Malaysia? Maybe that's too much together.
I think the signature breakfast in Singapore is soft-boiled eggs with kaya toast. So kaya jam is a spread that's made out of coconut, and it's cooked down until it's sort of lightly caramelized. And it has almost like a lemon curd type texture, but it's flavored with coconut. And you'll spread that onto white bread toast and then eat it with these super, super runny eggs. So, you know, I'm talking about eggs that are soft boiled to maybe 1 or 2 minutes. And you break them into a bowl, you stir in some soy sauce, and then you eat those savory eggs. And then you have this sweet toast on the side, the sweet kaya jam on the side. And that's really sort of the breakfast you have to get when you're in Singapore. Because I don't think you see it anywhere else in the region, really.
I don't think I've never heard of it. Kenji, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Kenji Lopez-Alt is author of the award-winning book, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. And you can find a recipe from his article, My Favorite Breakfast from Around the World. That's the recipe for Turkish scrambled eggs. They're called mememin. And you know where the recipe is. It's at splendidtable.org. Well, we think this is the year to empower the home cook. And we're happy to be taking on that task with one of the most popular how-to-cook shows on TV, America's Test Kitchen. Today, we're going to talk tools. But I'm not talking about knives and pots and pans. Instead, I'm talking about more culinary science, because that is a tool, and understanding a little of that gives the home cook a huge leg up. Molly Birnbaum and Dan Souza are the executive editors of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen. Molly, Dan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
So, could we talk about bitter tastes? Because it's curious that fast food, you know, which is so popular, and its appeal is salt, fat, and sugar, and yet people are really taking to these bitter foods, you know, the dark chocolate, the bitter greens, hoppy beers. So what do you think the story is here?
So bitterness is an incredibly complex flavor, which we have a very complex relationship to as humans. It's very individual. We all taste it differently, and we all feel very differently about it.
And at Cook Science, we were very interested in it, and we sent a reporter, Courtney Humphreys, out to Colorado She has a very interesting relationship with bitter herself, and she visited a place called Mycotechnology that is making bitter blockers that you can add to food. And then she's also visited a place where they're brewing beer that's very bitter and very hoppy. And we actually have a clip from her.
I felt like I had to go there just to try this thing because I couldn't quite believe that. I didn't know what it would be like to taste something that would block bitterness. They actually had me try the bitter blocker in beer, which was something I don't like the bitterness of. So that was really helpful for me. And it was really interesting because they put some of it diluted in some water and they added it to this beer. And it was an IPA, so it was a bitter beer. And I have to say, it really changed the taste dramatically as soon as they put it in. I mean, it was milder. It was almost like drinking a lager. I was like, wow, this craft IPA has become basically Budweiser.
So what's the science behind this bitter blocker?
So this bitter blocker, which is called Clear Taste by Mycotechnology, is made from mycelia on mushrooms. And you know, the mushrooms that grow in the forest, it's all natural and organic because it is made from these mushrooms. And these mycelia are made into a powder that can be put into liquid. And it contains molecules that temporarily stick to the taste receptors on the tongue and in your mouth to block the perception of bitter.
Huh.
And the reason that this is a kind of a popular thing now is that a lot of bitter foods can be very good for you. I mean, you mentioned bitter greens. A lot of the compounds like the phenols in bitter greens or in coffee, in chocolate, can be very good for you. But a lot of people don't like that bitter flavor. So bitter blockers are becoming quite popular. And I think one of the really interesting things about this is you find people who really like bitter things and who don't. When you look into why we do or don't like bitter, it's a much more complex taste than something like sweetness. We actually have 25 genes that code for bitter receptors on our taste buds, whereas for sweetness, we only have 2 genes that code for them. So sweet is really simple. If it's sweet, we know it has calories, and evolutionarily, that would be very helpful for us. Bitterness, on the other hand, often indicates toxicity. So it's something that we learn to like, and some people learn to like it better than others.
Like me, for example. I love good Brussels sprouts or dark chocolate. These foods with, you know, nice bitter edges, I think, add a lot of complexity. But it is something that you learn how to like. And the other interesting thing about having all of these genes that code for these taste receptors for bitter in your mouth is it really shows that we all taste bitter differently, which is another reason why some people like it and some people don't. Because there are so many differences in our taste receptors, there are a lot of differences in how we actually taste, say, a grapefruit or, you know, those Brussels sprouts that you get at the restaurant covered in bacon and maple syrup.
And that's what makes them more attractive.
Exactly.
The sweetness counteracts.
Right. It's a natural mask. You don't actually have to go to mushrooms to mask some of that bitterness.
So, Molly, Dan, what are some of the thoughts about using bitter in our cooking day to day?
Well, that's a really good question. It's interesting to see a lot of restaurants and chefs are incorporating things that don't sound good on the surface, like burnt vegetables or even vegetable ash. When we burn foods, we think that's generally a bad thing, and they definitely become really bitter. But chefs are using it almost as an extra layer of seasoning. So having a little bit of bitterness in there can add a lot more complexity to food. And so we've been playing around with that a lot in the test kitchen and for Cook Science. And we recently developed a recipe that uses charred, really almost burnt broccoli in a couple of interesting ways. And the first is that we take some of the top of the broccoli, the little florets, and we char them in a dry cast iron skillet until they're really pretty dark. And we blend that into a classic chimichurri sauce, which is an Argentinian herb sauce used a lot on steak. So it's got olive oil and herbs and fresh garlic. And normally it doesn't have a ton of bitterness. It's got a little bit from the herbs. But this charred broccoli adds a ton of flavor to it. So you get a really lot rounder, more interesting sauce. And we also char some broccoli to serve on the side.
It's a really delicious dish. We serve it with flank steak. It all can be done in under an hour. And that bitter char gives it this complexity and an interesting kind of flavor aspect to it. It's super good.
Really a challenging idea and an interesting one to try. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Molly Birnbaum and Dan Souza are the executive editors of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen. Now, to learn more about bitter flavors in everything from vegetables to beer, take a look at the story, Building a Better Bitter, from America's Test Kitchen. Then head to our website for a recipe from Mark Bitterman. It's for tangerine fennel salad with bitter celery vinaigrette. Coming up, rebel food journalist Betty Fussell, still at it in her 80s. And have you ever imagined harvesting olive oil with military protection? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Imagine 50 years of thinking and writing about food. Books, articles, lectures, classes. Now imagine boiling that all down to a single volume. At nearly 90, the esteemed food historian Betty Fussell has done just that and done it so well in her book, Eat, Live, Love, Die. Betty talked with our contributor, Shauna Sefer, an award-winning writer herself, from Betty's home in Santa Barbara.
Well, hi, Betty. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
I'm delighted to be here, believe me.
Well, I have to say, when I first found out I'd be speaking with you, I didn't even know where to begin. It's a little bit like maybe asking Queen Elizabeth about her decorating plans for the palace. It's
Queen Elizabeth and I are of similar age.
Well, from that comes an incredibly rich life. And so it's a little difficult to know where to begin. And then I realized maybe you had similar feelings in trying to distill 50 years of writing down into one volume of essays. How did you even begin to choose what to include in a book like this?
Well, you're absolutely right that selection is the hardest of all things. And I look back at the 50 years and I think, what was most important? And for me, the underlying sense is what food is and what it means, but, you know, that's abstract. I have been so lucky to have lived long enough to I can look back and say, oh my gosh, I've been here, I've been there, I have been alive when the whole food revolution began, the American food revolution, and it's the American food culture that is my passion.
And why do you think it is that food is such a powerful lens through which to examine our lives?
Because to eat is to live, and to live is to die. So, you know, the whole enchilada is embedded in our daily need, the requirement to eat. All critters eat. The first connection is baby says, feed me, and there's milk and there's mama. That's how we learn about other people. That's how we learn about the outside. So to eat is to know. And because I'm at the end of my life, I can look back and say, oh my God, the narrative is clearer and clearer. And every bite I eat, every meal I make, has the whole cycle in it. That is enormously exciting.
And I guess that brings you to the perfect title, the Eat, Live, Love, Die. It's just, it's all there.
And to my opening essay, Eating My Words, you know, what food is, it's not just substance, it's not just a thing. It is always a symbol, it is always an image. And to eat anything is an adventure, whether it's the thing you've eaten your entire life, or whether it's eating bugs in Australia, trying that out, how's that? Oops! Or an essay of mine that I love called On Murdering Eels and Laundering Swine. Mm-hmm. It's killing a live eel in my New York apartment and cleaning pig's guts to make chitlins. Okay, part of the world's standard foods. You learn a lot about food by doing it.
And you come back to that idea so many times throughout the book, the connection of language and eating, feeding and speaking, the mouth being used as a way to explore and interpret the world around us at the same time. That seems to be a central philosophy in a lot of your work.
It absolutely is, because food in our in the 20th century got swallowed up by nutrition, diet and health, by it's simply its chemical ingredients. And that is the least, what you eat is the least of it. In the 50s and 60s, really, when food became more abundant after the Depression and the abstinence of World War II, food becomes demonized. No fat, no salt, no butter. Or you're going to get fat, you're going to get disease. And the fear, to make food fearful, is criminal. So I'm trying to rescue food from the nutritionists and the whole industry of diet and health to say, no, there is no magic bullet. It is all here now. Food inevitably, eating inevitably leads to dying because living leads to dying. And therefore, look at it all now. Look at the whole, and you don't get distracted by things that are not important. So my whole thing is to look at the foods. You know, look at oysters. Look at Jell-O, processed foods. What does it mean? What is it about? You get this great hodgepodge here that you get no place else in the world.
And really what you just said, I think, describes what you do so perfectly. You really are the quintessential American food writer, that so much of what you do is focused on America and the way we eat, the history of our food. It's such a unique position that you've taken.
It never seems so to me, because I didn't begin with food. I began with, because I'm really a theater nut, meaning as a baby, I'm a movie nut. So that means pop culture is deep in my heart. And who invented movies, or who really created movies most, is the American culture. And I am created by that. So my first section is cultures, because I realize how embedded in my culture I am. My second section is people. The people I've been lucky enough to know are the great English pioneer Elizabeth David, and then our own great pioneers, MFK Fisher and Julia Child, of course. And here I am. I live in Santa Barbara at the place that she ended up, Casa Durinda, but I knew her well in the East. And James Beard, whom I lived one block from in New York City. Alice Waters, whom I met 30 years ago when she was just starting. And then I've been so lucky to write profiles on people like Edna Lewis, a wonderful Afro-American from Virginia, Marcus Samuelson from Ethiopia, Jean-Georges von Gerichten, our four-star Count of Cuisine from Alsace. All of these people come to America and cook and write and explore for us the whole rest of the cultures of all the countries in the world.
And you write about all of these people in your book and use them as sort of a way to demonstrate further this idea of American cooking and cuisine.
Well, this is the advantage of the periods I have grown up with, two revolutions. One, the revolution in travel. In the 50s, you know, travel became an industry and it didn't cost anything. We could travel everywhere. So I have eventually gone around the world to all these different countries, and I found that the great universal language was food. You didn't need anything. You didn't have to know Chinese to go to China and connect. And this was a revelation to me. So that's when I really started writing. And I found that I didn't have to go abroad to discover. I could discover at home with what I'd been doing as a housewife and mother for a good decade. I had been cooking in the kitchen, because that's where I belonged, you know, and I was very excited with feminism and all that, but I never wanted to give up the kitchen. No, I love the kitchen. I love the daily process of participating, and that's where I can explore the most. But I want to communicate that exploration, so I want to write.
Now, how do you see the future of food writing? Is it something that you think much about? Do you have any opinions on what you'd like to see more of or less of in this food media world that's always changing?
I'm simply dazzled and full of wonder and admiration at the digital revolution that is engulfing us all. So the iCloud world of food, what is that going to be like? I mean, we are millions of people who can connect every second, every day. What that's going to do, I have no idea in terms of food, except it certainly changes perception, because it changes our attention span, our sense of time. There is, you know, it eradicates place. We're all these little motes floating around in the iCloud. And yet, we are all subject to the same condition of change and cyclic change, which means life and death of the moat. And it's going to change into little blogs and Twitters and Snapchats and equal time with images. I love that. It's a mosaic. It's a mosaic that upsets, in a way, the formality of a splendid table and makes the table really accessible to every person in the world at the same time. That's an astonishing thing.
It is a long, endless table, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Betty. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to speak with you.
Shauna, the pleasure and privilege is mine entirely, and thank you.
Betty Fussell's latest book is Eat, Live, Love, Die. Shauna Seaver is author of Real Sweet, and she writes the Next Door Baker blog. Fall and winter olive harvests are usually scenes of a lot of hard work and a lot of fun. In the Mediterranean, whole villages pitch in, and once the pressing is finished, the feasting begins. Well, once the olive harvest on the West Bank was like that. Now, not so much. 2016 marked the 10th year some Palestinians have relied on the Israeli military and volunteer peacekeepers for protection as they harvest their olives. Shana Sheely takes us through a harvest day near the West Bank city of Nablus.
It's olive harvest season in the West Bank. Farmers climb ladders to reach high branches. They beat the branches with sticks. They comb them with plastic hand rakes and pull on them with bare hands. Olives fall onto canvas tarps, like raindrops. Here, the Ali family harvest around 7 sacks of olives every day to make about 22 gallons of olive oil. They say they make nearly half their yearly income just from selling olive oil. But the harvest means more than just income.
You can find trees that are 1,000 years old. It's a holy thing. Even if you manage a bank, you take time off to harvest olives.
I walk the olive grove with one of the farmers. He takes me to an old stone house where he slept with his family during the olive harvest when he was a kid. He points behind us to tin shacks.
Ah, those are settlers. So the settlers are right here. They're right, like, basically on the olive grove.
Yeah.
Like, how many meters do you think that is?
20 meters.
20 meters.
Some Israeli settlements are really close to Palestinian olive groves. And in recent years, some settlers have damaged Palestinian olive trees and beaten up Palestinians during the harvest. So the Israeli military dispatches soldiers to protect Palestinians picking olives. I want to give you a taste of how the time-honored Mediterranean tradition of olive picking unfolds in the thick of West Bank friction. It's a mix of serene and surreal. Today, there are some 15 volunteers helping the Ali family pick their olives.
Start taking them down.
They're from the U.S., the U.K., South Africa. There's one from Israel, Yael Vargon. She's studying to be a rabbi. She says she was here picking olives a week before when an Israeli settler came running, swinging a baseball bat.
And he was very full of hate to the people and really believe in a really strong belief that he's the chosen people and it's all his and what they're doing here.
Yael shows me a photo she took.
See him? I think he's wearing a little bit like a biblical period clothes.
She says she stood between the Palestinian family and the settler and she tried to reason with him, one Jew to another.
Explain to him, these people are working in their land. What do you want from them? Why are you hassling them? It's their land and their right to be working here. It's forbidden for us as Jews to steal from them their lands, their fruits, their trees. It did come down a little bit. He stopped yelling and he stopped running to them and he was standing there and then the police came and took him.
Yael says she's here as a peacekeeper to protect Palestinians. And also to break down barriers.
The other thing that happens is that you just get to know the people because Israelis never meet Palestinians. Maybe when they're soldiers or if they have workers who build their houses, but just to meet other people and eye to eye and you know have this basic human connection. That's also something very important that is happening.
I leave the farm and get into a car with Zacharias Sedeh.
I will do like
small. His job is to drive around the West Bank videotaping any evidence of settler interference in the Palestinian olive harvest. We drive grove to grove across open swaths of land peppered with olive trees. Settlements dot the hilltops. Zachariah points to a hill where Israeli forces watch over Palestinian olive pickers.
You can see the police car there, and you can see the farmers work. The army and the police protect for both sides. In the same time, to protect the settlers from the Palestinians and the Palestinians from the settlers.
Israeli military wouldn't say if Palestinians attack settlers during the olive harvest, but they say the troops patrol during the harvest to protect all West Bank residents. We drive south to a grove with some 800 trees. A Palestinian man leans against one of them.
My land from the end of the trees there to the end of the trees after about 1 kilometer.
Nabi Al-Dib is the chairman of the Palestinian Olive Oil Council. Years ago, he says settlers cut down almost all his trees.
When I come, I see all the trees on the ground. In Arabic, the man, he didn't cry. It is bad thing to cry because you are not a man if you cry. In that day, I sit down on the street and I cry.
He carries on about his trees when two Israeli soldiers drive toward us. I get nervous. But the soldiers are there to give Al-Dib ice-cold bottles of water on a hot day. No one's in trouble.
Normal. They come and shalom, shalom, and we have no problem with them.
At the end of the day, Al-Dib will bring his olives to the nearby mill.
Our olive oil here, it is very good because we take our fruits to the mills every 2 days. In my land, every year I have premium. I don't know how to describe it. The color, it is green, not yellow. It is like a little pepper, and I don't know how to say. In Arabic, I can't say. I hope I see you when I go to the mill, and you will taste it.
Finally, after a long day raking trees under the hot sun in the gaze of soldiers, I make it to the olive oil mill. It's late afternoon. A man helps his grandkids dump sacks of olives into a wash bin. The olives are cleaned, crushed, and pressed into oil so green it looks toxic. I empty my water bottle and hold it under the oil spout, collecting a liter of bright green liquid gold. I spill some onto a tear of warm tabbouleh bread. The olive oil is spicy and grassy and makes my throat tingle. There's nothing else like it.
Shaina Shealy is a freelance radio journalist based in Jerusalem. Coming up, time for me and you to talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to turn to your calls, brought to you by Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods. Now, you can join in the conversation by calling 800-537-5252 or connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. Holly is calling from Louisville. Holly, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. My daughter is about to be 21, and as is the norm here, I throw a little dinner party for her.
What a lovely thing.
I am a scratch cook, and she and her friends would really rather me cook for them than go out. But she'll be 21 this year, and I have been collecting wines from our various trips to Paris, and I plan to open those with a friend, a recent retiree from the spirits industry, who will teach my daughter and her how you say Captain Morgan crowd?
Yes.
about wine. Very, very cursory, you know,
yeah,
workplace type entertaining, that sort of thing. But I have two reds and a white from the Rhone region.
Right.
And I'm mostly looking for what I should cook to support these wines. Usually it's the other way around.
But when you're into wine, it's fun to cook to a wine, isn't it? When you know the characteristics of the wine, and then you figure out, okay, what's going to work best with that.
True.
Now, the characteristic of the whites coming out of the Rhone, they tend to be complex, and they tend to do well with foods that have character. For instance, if you're going to do seafood, you want something that is kind of plump in the mouth, maybe salmon, something like mackerel, or a delicate white meat dish, even something with a small amount of cream. And the Rhone red is usually a wine with a fair amount of muscle and again, yeah, complexity. But these are sort of the lush, big wines of the southern part of France. And they work beautifully with red meats like lamb and beef and things that are braised. And the lovely thing about braising is it's something that benefits from being done ahead.
Yeah.
What I would do with the white wine is something like a mushroom, wild mushroom soup with a very small amount of cream in it, made with a lovely broth, you know, a homemade stock, perhaps a chicken broth. The mushrooms are first browned. So you have small pieces of mushroom. You've cut them up into small pieces. You've sauteed them with a bit of onion and lots of shallots, some bay leaf and a bit of thyme. Okay. And you know, the other thing, just one or two cloves and also, of course, garlic. Then a small amount of tomato is added to the pan and then a little cream is reduced and then you add the broth and you simmer. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
And what's great about a soup, of course, is, you know, it can wait a bit on the stove. And, of course, making it ahead is great. There's a great traditional dish from further south, or the end of the Rhone, from the Provence area, which is a beef stew essentially done with the usual suspects, done in red wine, but with orange peel thrown in. And the name of it has just gone out of my mind. But you brown chunks of beef and you add, and usually you want to use either the shin, you know, the leg of the steer, or you want to use the shoulder, which would be the chuck. And you brown it slowly and really well. And then some celery and carrot and onion and little onions and some more. You could do mushrooms in this if you wanted, but carrots, potato, and of course, this orange peel, just fresh orange peel, the orange part, and you let that braise in the red wine. So that's what I would serve with the red wines.
Lynn, thank you so much. You're going to make it even more special.
I think it's a lovely gesture to do this for her and a lovely tradition to have a dinner party for when you turn 21. Thank you and happy birthday.
To thank your daughter. You.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, boy, is this ever the time of year to have even one chunk of beef, you know, like a pot roast that you've browned slowly on all sides in a skillet, and you're going to then put it in a nice pot with vegetables and lots of herbs and maybe some spices. You know, I'm big now on cinnamon stick and a little bit of clove and allspice, those kinds of things, even some ginger. And then you just close that pot and put it in a low oven and you can forget about it, you know, for hours. And the house will smell wonderful. And whenever you're ready to sit down and eat, you can cook some rice or you could do just having potatoes in the pot and make a bitter green salad, you know, with endive and curly endive and tart greens. And that's dinner. And it's party food. It's just wonderful. And if you want to, great to drink Rhone wines with that. Okay. You can get to us by calling us 800-537-5252. Marge is on the phone from Indianapolis. Marge, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Collard greens.
All right. Now you're singing my song. What about collard greens?
Well, mine were a disaster. A friend gave me some, and I think it was after the frost.
Yeah.
So that couldn't be why they were so bitter. I cleaned them, and or I chopped them up and put them in, you know, water with bacon and so forth.
Right.
And they were too stringy. So I said, okay, well, I'll cut the stems off. And so I cut the stems off and chopped them into smaller pieces.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that'll do it, you know. But then when I tasted them, they were bitter. Uh-huh. And they just didn't taste good. So I thought, I spent all that time chopping them up and taking the stems out and so forth. We're so time-consuming. I just wonder if there's an easier way to do it, and if so, what is it? And on top of all of that, after I had cut them up and taken the stems out, I forgot to put them on the table, and I put the ones that were stringy on the table and didn't realize it till the meal was over.
I have no doubt everything else was wonderful. A couple of things. Always stem collards. Collards are tough. You know, collards can cook until they're really soft and they melt in your mouth, but it takes time. And the older the collards, and if they've gone through a frost, they're older collards, they really need to be cooked a long time. And
I thought they're supposed to go through a frost. No?
Well, they can, yes. But I've had them fresh out of the garden in the middle of the summer, and then I've had them. No, they are good after a frost, but you've got to cook them a long time. And get rid of the stems, because the stems just are, you can't eat the stems. They get very tough. And
I know that.
Yeah, I know. It takes a few. Look, we all make mistakes. That's how we learn. When people say, how do you know so much? I've done so many things wrong, more than most people. So, so the thing is, first of all, get rid of the stems. Secondly, chop them up any way you'd like. But what you want to do then, and some people, by the way, like to saute them with a little bit of bacon or some kind of smoky ham, that kind of thing. And then you add broth or you add water, and then you just let them simmer and simmer and simmer until they're really tender. And know one thing, that at that point, a lot of the nutrition is in the liquid, and it's wonderful. You can, you know, in fact, one of the things I've done in the past is I've cooked it with just, you know, liquid to cover it. And when they get really tender, I'll put them in the fridge overnight, so I can take all the fat off and then warm them up. And I serve them like a little broth, you know, with the collards in it. I have chopped them up fairly fine. But that's the basic idea. They're a tough green. Tough in the sense that they're, how can I put it? They're denser than a lot of greens. And, you know, chard will cook in minutes. Spinach will cook really quickly. Collards need a little babying. So that's the trick. And I think maybe if you'd cooked them longer, they, you know, you would have had a better result. But that's the only way we find out. I hate to say it, but so do that, and I think you'll be happy. Yeah. Oh, don't give up on them. They're really good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You are welcome, Marge.
Bye bye.
800-537-5252. That's how you can get to us. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, too. If there ever was an official month of dieting, it is January. Low carb, low fat, paleo, all get pushed to the side this year because this is the year of Buddha's diet. Dan Sigmund is a writer, director of analytics for Facebook, and a Zen priest. He's also co-author of Buddha's Diet, The Ancient Art of Losing Weight Without Losing Your Mind. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, got some detail on this fairly ancient diet.
Hey, Dan, nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Dan, most of us, when we think of the Buddha, think of this round, full-figured, seated, beatific man. Is that who Buddha was?
So that's not the Buddha. So that figure that we see in Chinese restaurants and sometimes yoga studios and so forth, the kind of jolly, almost Santa Claus-like man, is actually a Chinese monk who lived about 1,000 years later and who traveled all around China and was kind of seen as a bringer of good luck and good fortune and became a symbol of happiness and abundance. And it's somehow here in this country and in the West, we've gotten confused about this person and started to think about that person as the Buddha. Buddha was born to a royal family in, I guess, what is now Nepal. And so he lived his early years as a prince. When he was born, his parents, as I guess was common at the time, asked a fortune teller to come and give a prediction about what his life would be. And the fortune teller said there were two possibilities. Either he would become a great ruler or he would become a great sort of holy man. And his parents knew which one of those they liked better, and so they tried everything they could to steer him towards the life of kind of royalty. So they pampered him. He got everything he wanted. They were kind of the original helicopter parents. They kind of just made sure that he really never had a bad day. And he lived that way for many years until he was kind of a young man. And then he decided he wanted to see the world. And so he snuck out of the palace one day, and he was confronted with the fact that the world was not this sort of Shangri-La where he had been living. And he decided to sort of pack it in and try the life of a wandering ascetic in ancient India.
It's funny to think of getting lifestyle diet advice from Buddha. How does the diet fit in with this that you write about?
Well, so Buddha, you know, basically lived these two very different lives. So first he lived this life of luxury, and then he lived this life of extreme hardship. And what he decided after a certain point was that neither of these was the path that would kind of relieve the basic suffering that he saw all around him. And so instead he found this middle way, which kind of avoided either extreme of either, you know, indulging in luxury or beating himself up with these hardships.
And very practical information about that, correct?
And very practical information. So, for example, it was very common for these wanderers to fast for long periods of time, to eat almost nothing. And he even tried this for a long time, and he fasted so long that he almost died at some point. But what he decided was that, you know, that really wasn't going to accomplish anything. That wasn't going to help anybody. And so instead, he found this balanced approach where you would eat for certain hours each day, but then you would also fast for certain hours each day. And that's exactly what we suggest in Buddha's diet, that we limit our eating to a certain period. We suggest 9 hours. And after that time, we're not eating. So each day basically combines a period of eating and a period of fasting in balance.
And there's science behind this, correct?
Absolutely. So we had the good fortune to spend some time with Dr. Sachin Panda down at the Salk Institute in San Diego, and he's done a tremendous amount of research on this, and other labs have too, where he's looked at the effect of what's generally called intermittent fasting and has found all kinds of beneficial effects. You know, in particular, it really does seem to prevent many of the negative consequences that we're all very familiar with overeating. The key is just that each day you really limit your meals to a roughly 9-hour eating window. So the hours that I tend to eat are 9 to 6. You can shift that around a little bit. Some people prefer to eat a little bit later. Some people find it easier to start a little bit earlier.
And I want to say eating includes wine, right? So you may be done with your dinner at 7, but having a glass of wine after counts as food, correct?
Absolutely. Anything with calories, really. The idea is that you're really trying to give your body, your digestion, your metabolism, a complete rest. And so black tea, black coffee, you know, water, those things are fine. And I love tea and have tea in the evenings often. But wine and other alcohol absolutely counts.
So what was Buddha's goal with this diet? It was just his way of finding the middle?
It was his way of finding balance, that's right, of kind of keeping food in its place, if you will. So he wasn't preaching this so that people would look good in a swimsuit or anything like that, but he just thought this was a healthy and mindful way to live.
So in the book, you also talk about other things that Buddha believed in. Can you tell us some of those kind of hands-on living ideas that he had?
Absolutely. Buddha, and this surprises a lot of people, was actually pretty into exercise. He walked all the time. Every day, he started his day by taking a long walk, you know, through the local villages, And of course, this being ancient India of 2,500 years ago or so, when he was going from province to province, he was doing all of that on foot. So he got quite a bit of exercise, and that's something that I think we have also lost a bit today. He also talked about sleep. He talked about the amount we sleep as being a little bit like the string of an instrument, that when it's too loose, it doesn't really work, and when it's too tight, it doesn't really work. And so again, we have to find that right balance where, you know, he didn't want anybody necessarily sleeping till noon, but he wanted to make sure that everybody got enough sleep that they could really function and be mindful during the day.
It's that middle way, again.
Exactly, the middle way.
Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dan Sigmund is co-author of Buddha's Diet. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and we're going to talk next week. But in the meantime, I want to leave you with this thought from Anonymous, who said, "There is considerable enthusiasm for mindfulness these days, as long as it does not threaten to make us wise." Now, if you like what you heard here today, subscribe to our podcast, follow us on Instagram and Pinterest. And of course, you can find information on everything you heard here today at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Thanks to Adam Raskin and Neil Harris for help with the West Bank olive oil piece. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk next week. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper. This is APM, American Public Media.